From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety, we talk with Judith Warner about her new bestseller, Perfect Madness. She writes, "A shocking cocktail of guilt and anxiety and resentment and regret is poisoning motherhood for American women today." Also, we hear from novelist Bruce Wagner. He was described in Entertainment Weekly as the leading literary chronicler of the Hollywood scene, spinning dark-hued tales of bizarro L.A., where celebrities, both real and fictitious, collide with a motley parade of wannabes, has-beens, and hangers-on. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although many women today are liberated from what Betty Friedan described in the pre-feminist 60s as the feminine mystique, many mothers today are burdened by a new set of life-draining pressures, writes my guest Judith Warner. Warner calls this the mommy mystique. She says the climate in which we now mother is in many ways just plain crazy. Warner describes her new book, Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety, as a snapshot of motherhood as she found it from 2000 to 2004 in Washington, D.C. and its suburbs, the area where she lives with her husband and two children. Perfect Madness is a bestseller. Nightline devoted an edition to it. Newsweek made it a cover story. Warner is the author of a biography of Hillary Clinton, and she collaborated with Howard Dean on his book, You Have the Power. She's a former special correspondent for Newsweek in Paris. In your book, you write that a cocktail of guilt and anxiety and resentment and regret is poisoning motherhood for American women today. Can you describe what you mean by that cocktail?
It was the feeling that I came upon when I moved here and I started spending a lot of time with other stay-at-home moms on the playground after preschool drop-off or before pickup. It was a time when I had just moved here, moved to a new country. I had been in France before that, and I didn't have childcare. I couldn't actually afford childcare. I was doing what writing I could do in the evenings, and so I had a lot of time on my hands and was hanging out with other moms. And it was sort of a new world to me coming here, being with stay-at-home moms. I had always been working in the past, and hearing what they had to say about their lives and just the way they talked about their lives, and that cocktail, that mixture of negative feelings, was something that I heard over and over again, and I was really surprised to hear, coming in particular from this group of women I encountered who seemed to me to have everything and to have lives that were so easy, and who frankly inspired a certain amount of jealousy in me, because their lives did seem to be so easy and secure.
And I should mention here that you're talking specifically about very middle or upper middle class women.
That's right.
What were some of the resentments that this group of women felt?
There were two that stuck out particularly in my mind. One was an enormous resentment often of their husbands, who had turned them, they felt, sort of into personal assistance because they were at home, and so they ostensibly had all this time on their hands. They were necessarily free to do their husband's errands and take in his dry cleaning and just sort of do everything he didn't have the time to do or didn't feel like doing. And from their perspective, they didn't actually have all this time on their hands because they were with small children who kept them running constantly. And they didn't appreciate the fact that then their husbands would come home from work and expect to be able to relax and not be bothered with everything that had to be done in the evenings. And their resentment was very deep, and they were often very angry. And the other form of resentment that struck me was a resentment towards other women, working mothers, or working women, I guess, in particular, who treated them as though they were boring or just not very important.
So it sounds like one complaint you encountered was that women who decided to stay home to raise their children and who gave up a career found themselves falling into the whole kind of old gender role, and that, you know, to stay home meant taking on the whole gender division between husband and wife.
That's right. And the problem was that they weren't socialized to do that. So that while they were, you know, willing partners in the life that they had set up for themselves, for the most part willing partners, you know, they hadn't been socialized throughout the 30 or 35 years that preceded the situation to play those kind of roles. And it was a difficult fit. I also think, I mean, for some women, this was really what they wanted to be doing. This was definitely a choice. And for some, it was actually a fulfillment of an ambition. But for others, it was a lesser of various evils. Their husbands worked extremely long hours. If they had had full-time careers as well, there literally would have been no one home with the kids, basically ever. And so facing that situation, it became clear to them that if anyone was going to be taking care of the kids and taking care of the household, something was going to have to give, and that was going to be their careers. So these were choices, but not exactly entirely free choices for some of these women.
Now, you said that what you encountered in Washington, D.C. when you moved there was different from the environment that you started raising your children in France. What was different about France?
The whole social environment was different. I mean, there were all of the things that everyone knows about, you know, that are very different, meaning the social supports, the governmental supports, the things that simply made middle-class family life a lot easier. But beyond that, there was a whole atmosphere that was different in that mothers were not expected to lose themselves in their children and in motherhood. In fact, that was not considered a good or healthy thing to do. They were expected and encouraged to maintain lives for themselves. And this was true whether you were a working mother or a stay-at-home mother. You were supposed to still have a romantic life with your husband. You were supposed to still have a social life. You were supposed to just generally maintain yourself as an adult woman and not be kind of sucked down entirely into the children's realm.
Well, you also found in France that there was a set of supportive family policies that helped women work and be mothers.
That's right. There were policies that definitely allowed a better sort of balance to be struck in many women's lives, whether it was limitations on the length of the work week or simple things like the fact that there is a long paid maternity leave, the fact that there's a possibility for either parent actually to stay home for up to 3 years after the birth of a child and have a job held for them afterwards. It may not necessarily be the same job that they had before, but a job so they can take time off to spend more time with their children when they're of preschool age without fearing that they're just not going to be able to get back into the workforce again. And then there are all other different kinds of subsidies or tax breaks, which generally together make middle-class family life a lot more affordable and give women a lot more options in terms of how they set up their lives.
Would you compare for us what life for you as a mother was like in France versus what it was like when you moved to Washington?
For the first 18 months of being a mother, when my first daughter was born, I was working for Newsweek in an office. After that, I was working from home, writing books, and doing freelancing. And the various transitions of my life, first from being childless to being a mother, then to working from home, all happened relatively seamlessly because childcare was so available and affordable. So that I didn't have to at each point make these agonizing choices. When I started to work less and work from home and spend more time with my daughter, it didn't mean, as it does for so many women in America, that I had to give up the hope of having childcare, hence having the ability to do some work and having to have some time for myself. Not only did I have a nanny who also was a housekeeper, I was able to send my daughter as she got older to part-time preschools, which also was very, very affordable. And all of this just came together easily without the incredible worry and logistical difficulties and expense that mothers typically encounter when they try to set up their lives with their kids in America.
What is it that made childcare more affordable? Why were you able to hire a nanny and send your daughter to a good preschool in France and then find it so hard in the States?
Partly the salaries of nannies were much lower, but partly also there were tax breaks and subsidies. I had an enormous tax break for having a nanny who was declared, who was legally declared. There was a big tax break. There was also help from the government in paying for her Social Security benefits, which is a great thing because it meant that she did have Social Security benefits. She had health care and everything else, and yet the cost of providing that for her was not crippling, because the government helped support it. Also then, when my daughter started preschool, these preschools received subsidies from the government. They were not government-run. I think that there is a misconception in America that these services in France come somehow directly from the government. They don't. One preschool was run by a Catholic organization. One was run by a neighborhood co-op of stay-at-home moms. But with government subsidies, so that they were able to have a sliding scale of fees to bring in people of different income levels. And the fees were never terribly onerous. For my daughter, I think it was about $150 a month for her to attend 3 afternoons a week. And I knew that whatever care she was getting was of very high quality because there were government quality controls.
we've talked a little bit about your life as a mother and about your children. What about your husband? Has he had a really consuming career? Has he been able to, you know, pitch in and help with the parenting?
When we lived in France, I think that we shared the parenting much closer to 50-50. We both worked full-time and yet not very long hours. He worked 35 hours a week, which sounds, even it sounds strange to me now because it sounds so short, but basically he did work 35 hours a week, and I probably worked about 32 hours a week. So we both had a decent amount of time. He also had an enormous amount of vacation. I think he had about 10 weeks of vacation. So we were able to have, I think that played a big role in our having a very, very pleasant life. I had first a month of vacation, and then obviously when I wasn't working in an office anymore, I could take as much vacation as I wanted to because I was setting my own hours. So all of that meant that we were able to split things very, very evenly. Since moving here, he has worked many more hours than I do. He initially was working nights, which the one good side of which was that he was around during the day and was able to come to school events all the time and be with the girls in the afternoons. The downside, obviously, was that he was profoundly exhausted all the time. Now he works days, but he works very long hours.
My guest is Judith Warner, author of the bestseller Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Judith Warner, author of Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. When we left off, she was talking about her first few years of motherhood when she lived in Paris. I asked her if she was able to find affordable childcare when she and her family moved to Washington, D.C.
None of it was affordable. My daughter began, she was older by then, so she began preschool, which was expensive, as preschool is in America. And frankly, at the beginning, the cost of getting a nanny was too high. So I just worked at night after the children went to bed. And in this, I think, I mean, this, my own personal story is not terribly interesting or significant, but I have heard it echoed over and over again in other stories that women tell me, where they're having to make choices about what to do with their lives based on the fact that they can't afford the options arrayed before them. And so many women in America have no choice but to put their children in really substandard care because it's all that they can afford. Things in this regard could be very, very different if we were willing to just step up to the plate and put our money where our mouth is on family values.
And you're talking about government policies, tax breaks.
I'm talking about government policies, which could make, which could bring women so many more options than they have now and could relieve so much of the stress weighing down on families now.
Yeah, what policies would you like to see?
I'd like to see tax breaks, better and bigger tax breaks for people who use childcare. And, you know, we're talking here about a benefit that would not just be for working mothers. It would be for stay-at-home moms, too, who simply need a break. And I think in talking about this, we have to remember that the lives of working mothers and stay-at-home moms in America is less different than most people generally think that it is. If you look at the statistics, you see that a very large percentage of stay-at-home moms actually work, whether it's during the school day or whether it's at night or on weekends or for a couple of hours here or there. And they really need some kind of good options to help make this a possibility and make it something that isn't just horrifically difficult for them. They also, even if they don't work at all, they need a break. Part of what makes stay-at-home motherhood in America so incredibly difficult and exhausting and psychologically draining right now is that many, many stay-at-home moms don't get any kind of break because they can't afford it. And this isn't right. This is a country that tends to really push stay-at-home motherhood and hold it up as a great virtue. And we do stay-at-home moms an enormous disservice in holding this up as a virtue, but not making it a livable reality. We've got to think about that, too.
You write in your book about how a lot of women who had careers and gave them up, at least temporarily, to be full-time mothers, took a lot of the ambitiousness and drive and even competitive spirit of their professions and put it into parenting. Can you describe what you mean by that? The way you saw that expressed?
I think that many of us, having been socialized a certain way all of our lives, don't know how to do anything else. We don't know how to stop achieving, or how to slow down, or how to relax, because we never have done those things. And once we're mothers, we just take the mode of being that we've had throughout our lives and continue it and generalize it into the work or the act of motherhood. And this is true whether whether we're talking about stay-at-home moms or working moms. And I think that part of what makes life so incredibly difficult for working mothers today is that they have the exact same high-level parenting ambitions that stay-at-home moms do, and yet they just have fewer hours in the day to make good on them. And so those hours tend to become even more packed with edifying activities and with the sense that they need to get the most out of all that time and be doing the best for their kids. And the pressures that they put on themselves are even more cruel in a sense because they're having to top off their workday with these same kinds of pressures and at-home ambitions. And I think that accounts for a lot of the really awful stress that you see working mothers going through.
Did you find yourself doing things when you moved to Washington that you didn't expect you'd be doing, obsessing about things that you didn't expect to, and planning things you didn't expect to be planning?
Absolutely. I mean, I found myself becoming in some ways unrecognizable. I began to obsess about things like planning birthday parties or whether my older daughter should be working with certain kinds of pre-K skill books, those skill handbooks that they sell in toy stores or in bookstores that I would see on other people's bookshelves. I would go to someone else's house, let's say, and see an entire collection of pre-K skill books and see the magic markers sorted from the crayons and sorted from the colored pencils and labeled in bins and with the paper stacked up a certain way and all the edifying educational games stacked up perfectly somewhere else and an entire sort of wardrobe of dress-up clothes hung neatly on hangers. And I'd think, well, I haven't done any of these things and I don't have any of these things. And my children, I suppose, are being neglected in some way and I'd better get with the program. And, you know, this is a way of thinking that I would, on the one hand, laugh at myself, but on the other hand, couldn't keep from indulging in and doing.
You know, one of the concerns you express, and I think this is interesting, I'd like you to talk about this a little bit, is that you think the physical boundaries between mother and child have eroded in a way that's been damaging to the mother. For example, examples you give include, the emphasis on long-term breastfeeding, the emphasis on having children climb into your bed and, spend time in your bed sleeping next to you. Would you elaborate on that a little bit?
I think that what most people seem to practice today is a kind of watered-down form of attachment parenting. And what attachment parenting recommends is basically physical attachment to a baby and to, a very young child, where you breastfeed for a very, very long time and you sleep in the family bed and baby wearing and all the rest of it. And I should just say, I practiced this watered-down form of attachment parenting too, so I didn't exclusively bottle feed or have my children sleep in it far away from me. I did all of this too. And I think that what happens is that women become really physically drained. And I think that that can be, depending on the degree to which they practice it, I think that this can be actually physically damaging for them and certainly psychologically damaging for some if it just drains away all the energy that they have for themselves. And I think that also from what educators are starting to say and some child psychologists are starting to say, that the incredible enmeshment that tends to be happening between mothers and children, and also to a lesser extent, but also between fathers and children, is actually not good for children in the long run, because they are seeing themselves too much as the center of the universe and are not developing a necessary level of independence, a sense of their own boundaries, and a sense of their own abilities to deal with the world. Now, this doesn't just have to do with attachment parenting. It has to do with forms of parenting that are going on once the kids are getting older, and the kind of over-involvement with children extends, with where parents are becoming way too involved in what's going on in school, are having trouble separating from their children physically and psychologically, and you're seeing educators who are starting to complain about this and talking about the negative effects on children. And psychologists, too, who are starting to talk about the anxiety that they're seeing in children and adolescents and young adults, too, where kids who just basically have never been given the opportunity to stand on their own feet and develop a sense of mastery out in the world are facing the world and feeling powerless and frightened.
Judith Warner is the author of the bestseller Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Bruce Wagner about his latest Hollywood novel, Chrysanthemum Palace, about the children of famous parents. The main character's father created the longest-running science fiction series on TV, Star Watch: The Navigators. Also, we continue our interview with Judith Warner about motherhood in the age of anxiety. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judith Warner, author of the bestseller Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. It's about what she describes as the cocktail of guilt, anxiety, resentment, and regret that is poisoning motherhood for American women today. The women who you're writing about in your book, your generation, this is women who were born roughly between like 1958 and 1972. Is that about right?
Yes.
So what do you think are some of the, like, biggest social issues or social changes that shaped your generation's thoughts about what motherhood or marriage or career should be, or what the balance of all of that should be?
Well, I think the most striking thing about my generation is that we didn't really think about those things. It didn't dawn on us that we were going to have to balance or make plans about all of this or really give anything up. I mean, we're a very, very privileged generation in that the battles of the women's movement were fought for us, and we inherited the successes of the women who came before us, and we just reaped all of the rewards of the women's movement as our natural due. And we didn't think that we were going to have to really do battle for much of anything, and we didn't have to do battle for much of anything, most of us. And we weren't prepared to think that when we became mothers that we would start having to make compromises or changes in our lives. I mean, this just was not a conscious issue. And I think then when we encountered limitations, it came as a huge shock. And it bred in us a huge sense of resentment and frustration and outrage. And I think part of the reason now, I find that now that the book has come out, a fair number of baby boomer women, I think, hear about it. I think they tend to feel this less if they actually read it, but when they just hear about it, they tend to have an immediate reaction of, what are these women whining about? I don't want to hear it. And I think they feel this way because their situation was very different. They had to battle for what they won, and they're perfectly aware of the fact that we have it easier, that we take a lot of things for granted, and that to a large degree we turned up our noses at them and sort of found them a bit overmuch and thought that we ourselves were somehow cooler and more together and not angry and not fighting. And so I think that they hear our complaints now and think, well, you know, what did you expect? What did you think was going to happen?
I guess the part of what you said that surprises me the most is that you think that you and other women of your generation expected to grow up and not have to really fight hard to maintain some kind of balance between motherhood and career. And the only reason why that surprises me is because it seems to have been such a kind of constant issue since at least the early 70s. It's a kind of issue I think in a way just like never went away.
That's absolutely true. I don't think we were paying attention. I don't think we felt that it applied to us. I think that we had such a sense of our own power and our own ability to control our lives that it didn't dawn on us that things would arise that would be out of our control, like the fact that basically society wasn't ready to deal with working mothers and hadn't changed in ways that would really allow women to balance their lives. We were a generation who came of age in the Reagan years, who were part of a political culture that privatized everything, that really put an emphasis on personal responsibility, as the buzz phrase was and continues to be, that really spurned social solutions and looking outwards and thinking of things collectively, and grew up and came of age with a real emphasis on what we were going to do for ourselves, how we were going to control our surroundings. We were also a very materialistic generation and very much sort of keyed into career success. And so I just don't think we were looking outwards to take in what was going on in society at large, or to think more globally about what was happening to women when they sought to balance their lives. Even, you know, women who were keyed into feminism in these years, the university feminism of these years wasn't so much about social change in terms of childcare, work-family balance, et cetera, et cetera. It was about close to the bone, close to the body concerns, sexual violence, pornography, the whole issue of eating disorders and how they, you know, came into being as a feminist issue. And of course, the big, big feminist issue for our generation was choice, abortion rights, which again is a very private focus of concern.
Do you think that maybe one of the morals of the story is that being the mother of young children is just always going to be hard. that it's just always going to be hard no matter what the circumstances are, whether you're working or not working or married or single. It's just always going to be hard.
No, I don't think so. That's everyone says that. I don't think it has to be hard. I think it can be a joy. I think it is a joy, basically. It has basically been a joy for me. I think that it is hard in America because of the cultural pressures, because mothers are almost entirely unsupported. I don't think it has to be hard. I think that with an alleviation of some of the psychological and social and economic pressures that bear down on mothers, and with better support generally, support from husbands, support from society, decent childcare, and available and affordable childcare of whatever kind and to whatever number, you know, for whatever number of hours any individual family might need. I don't think it has to be hard. I really don't.
Judith Warner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Judith Warner is the author of the bestseller Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. Coming up, Bruce Wagner talks about writing satirical novels set in Hollywood. This is Fresh Air. My guest Bruce Wagner writes satirical novels set in and around Hollywood that chronicle today's popular culture and the lives of the people who create it, or want to. His novels include I'm Losing You, Still Holding, and Force Majeure. His new novel is called The Chrysanthemum Palace. Reviewing it in the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani wrote, if The Great Gatsby were set in contemporary Hollywood, it might look a lot like The Chrysanthemum Palace. These are Americans ensnared by their fate, but gallant and brave to the end. The story revolves around three people who are the adult children of celebrities. One is the daughter of a movie star, one the son of a famous writer. The main character's father created TV's longest-running syndicated space opera, Star Watch: The Navigators. All three of the main characters have parts on the show. Here's a short reading.
My name is Bertram Valentine Crone, Valentine being the hero of Stranger in a Strange Land, and Henry Miller's middle name, too. Dad baptized me thus and really showed his hand. I'm 38 years old, but most everyone calls me Bertie. The Valentine-giving father is Perry Needham Crone, creator-producer in perpetua of TV's longest-running syndicated space opera, Star Watch: The Navigators. You may have heard of him. He continues after many years to be a staple of Variety, The Times, The Beverly Hills Courier, and 213, not so much for his deal-making activities, but in conjunction with whatever organization happens to be paying tribute. I should say he's paying them. Which seems to occur on a bi-monthly basis. You see, Dad likes lending his name to good causes, attracting old, new money to new, old diseases, relishing the hubbub of silent auctions and black tie balls, says it keeps him young. Mom hates all that, but I think vanity prevents her from attending the galas. More about her later. I was raised, as you might have guessed, in a world of great privilege. In fact, sad as it may sound, I've always considered Bertie Crone, the early years, to be among the happiest of my life. And while this document tilts more toward reportage than memoir, the thought occurred it might be ideal to recount a few personal anecdotes from that era of my youth. My girlfriend at the time, we were all of us nearly 13, was the aforementioned Clea Freemantle, daughter of legendary film actress Roosevelt Chandler, née Delia LeMay Chaikin. I doubt that things have much changed, but back then, rich kids began having serious parties at a fairly tender age, facilitated not only by the handy venue of mansions, shadowy acreage, and multiple trysting zones, but the inept, well-meaning agenda of absentee parents zealously contriving to watch over scions through the indulgent, lackadaisical eyes of long-time live-in help. We young royals did plenty of Frenching and groping and cupping of half-breasts. We commandeered various guest rooms for musky, R-rated kisses under the benign gaze of Mom in movie poster form.
That's Bruce Wagner reading from his new novel, The Chrysanthemum Palace. Bruce Wagner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why are you so interested in the lives of the children of the famous?
Well, You know, it's funny because an alternate title, a kind of working title for this book, was simply The Children of. I grew up in Beverly Hills from the age of around 8 years old, and I was constantly exposed to the children of famous or wealthy people. When I was a boy, I lived down the street from movie stars. I went to the Beverly Wilshire Hotel to a drugstore that was open 24 hours a day called Milton F. Kreis and picked up Variety for my father, who was a kind of fledgling producer. And I would see people like Groucho Marx or Tony Curtis. I walked to Beverly Hills High School past Gregory Way and Peck Street. So I was saturated, super saturated in show business and that kind of deformed and contagious world. So I would say that was an early kind of obsession that informed me almost on a cellular level, and my work is similarly informed by this gulf, this chasm between the haves and have-nots.
In your novel Chrysanthemum Palace, the main character, who's the son of the creator of the Star Trek type show, he starts out wanting to be an actor, in fact, to be a revolutionary actor. So he does Artaud in the Nude, and he stages a controversial all-white production of A Raisin in the Sun. And he turns to writing because he's a failed actor. He doesn't quite make it as an actor. How did you start writing? Did you want to be a something else in Hollywood first?
I think that I was word-obsessed from a very young age. I worked in bookstores when I dropped out of Beverly Hills High School. I stole books by the hundreds. They were fetish-like objects for me. I possessed them. I slept with them. I read them. I reread them. I absorbed them. I had an absolute love affair with the book and the written word, and I still do. So that's always been key for me. I think that I was astonished at the slow process of becoming a novelist. I think that it's something that is not encouraged in schools. Novels are things that you can study or write essays about, but not write. So I began very slowly, and I think screenwriting was something that reared its head as something more doable, less imposing, less terrifying to me.
You know, you're writing about a world that so many people would like to be in, the world of Hollywood, the world of celebrities. And, you know, reading your work made me think about this time I was in a car, or a limo kind of car, and the driver was telling me that he used to be the driver for Mike Douglas. And he told me he obviously had such affection for Mike Douglas and his wife, and telling me all these, like, you know, stories illustrating, you know, what a wonderful guy Mike Douglas was and everything. And that seems so interesting to me. I mean, obviously, that was this driver's brush with the world of celebrity, and it meant so much to him to have, like, his celebrity. You know, like, Douglas, it was like his personal celebrity.
Yeah, I drove a limo, you know, at the Beverly Hills Hotel for years, it's one of those strange things. You do become an extension of whoever you have in your car. We were also very merciless with celebrities when they tipped us poorly, I have to say.
Like, what would you do?
Well, we would be flat out rude to them at a certain point. I remember one someone that I just adored, and it didn't matter. Was Olivia de Havilland, and I was just obsessed with her from that movie Snake Pit, and you know, she gave me $2 once, and I don't say that in any rancorous way at all. It was the dearest, sweetest thing. Because I was with her in the limousine, and there were fire alarms, and she said, Let's go find that. She said it sounds as if it's newsworthy. But, you know, I was 26, and Snake Pit was so vivid in my mind. It's something that I watched through all my depressions, you know, year after year on television in black and white. And I just adored her. But there were other, you know, there were celebrities that were that we're not bigger than life, that you know, we're rude to us, or, you know, I often wound up being in business weirdly with people that I had driven in the limousine, and to this day they don't know it. I know they're the worst parts of them.
Well, you probably saw a completely different side of them than you want to take a meeting with them, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the key humiliating episodes in something that I wrote did not happen to me, but it happened to a chauffeur that I wrote about, Bud Wiggins, in Force Majeure, you know, where he pitches something, and then his night job is driving a limo, and the people that he pitched his story to climb into the limo on a very rainy night, and you can't see 2 feet in front of you, let alone the darkness that a driver is sheathed in, and they're just, you know, annihilating him. They're just mocking him and saying what an absurd, you know, pitch that was, and what a spastic personality this guy was. And he's just, you know, he's getting smaller and smaller as he drives them, you know. So I do try to use, you know, in a surface way, I extrapolate, you know, from things that have happened to me. And then, of course, I plunge off the cliff into just sheer invention.
My guest is Bruce Wagner. His new novel is called The Chrysanthemum Palace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bruce Wagner. He writes satirical novels set in and around Hollywood. His new one is called The Chrysanthemum Palace. When we left off, we were talking about working as a limo driver in Hollywood before he became a writer. Now, you drove an ambulance for a while, too, didn't you?
Yes, I drove an ambulance, and that was astonishing for me because I saw the dead for the first time. I was in morgues, and I was 18 years old.
You know, I'm thinking when you're driving a limo for someone, and that's a time when if they're the type, they can really lord it over you and put on airs and be pompous or whatever. But when someone's really sick and they need an ambulance, that's not the time for them to be pretentious or or snobbish or anything like that. So did you see, I mean, did you have, like, you know, brushes with the rich and famous driving an ambulance and see a kind of different side of things?
You know, I used to joke and say that driving wealthy or famous people in limousines was the same as driving terribly sick people in ambulances. there wasn't really much of a difference. But, you know, it's just driving a dysfunctional celebrity in a limousine, or someone that does not have a lot of money but is acting as if they do, comparing that to things that I did, such as taking a woman who was catatonic and who's a young woman, a young pretty woman whose clothes they had to scissor off her at the emergency room, taking her in a straitjacket from Los Angeles to Camarillo while it was still there. You ultimately, yes, the difference is quite large, but then there is this strange moment, almost in dream time, where you are just driving. You know, you're not judging. you're just driving, and the act of performing that service is very complex and very interesting, and opened for me a lot of fictional worlds.
Like, what's a scene from one of your novels that's drawn on your experience as an ambulance driver?
One time we were called to an emergency room in West Hollywood, and I put this in my first novel, Force Majeure. There was a woman who had been shot through the temple, and everyone had assumed that it was a suicide because there was a note. But the problem was that they couldn't find a gun. And immediately that raised a lot of flags. We transported the woman to County General Hospital, and we brought her upstairs to the neurological unit. And when we transferred her from the gurney to her hospital bed, the gun clattered onto the floor and everyone froze. What had happened is the firemen, when they picked her up at her apartment, had taken her whole bed sheet, as they sometimes did, just to facilitate her transfer to the gurney. And so the gun was tucked under her body in the bed sheet. And that, to me, I became, over the next few days, I checked on her, and she didn't make it. But that was something where I became emotionally attached and involved because of that novelistic detail that it happened, the mystery, and then the solving of the mystery in my presence. It became very, very real, very tactile for me.
Did the gun go off when it hit the ground?
Thankfully, no. But that was the moment where everyone froze because, you know, it was as if suddenly that there was a python in the room. I think they even call those guns pythons. But there was something poisonous in the room that could kill. And no, luckily it didn't go off.
You know, I almost feel like illness and pain and discomfort are like characters in your novels. You know, whether it's like bowel cancer or migraines or rashes. And I'm interested in hearing about why that plays such a prominent part in your writing, which I suppose is no surprise considering the prominent role it plays in most of life, but
yeah.
Thought I'd ask.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because people meet me and they say, God, you're so sunny, you're so, you know, you don't look at all like this person that does these excavations. I think it's an odd way of familiarizing myself with what's to come. You know, I know that sounds morbid, but I really do feel that, that, you know, for example, I always had a tremendous fear of flying. And in Still Holding, I have a character that has a tremendous fear of flying. And she takes a special course for people that have a terrible fear of flying. And the course ends with a graduate flight. Now, this is real. This is from real life. What's not from real life is that the graduate flight crashes in my book. So I think the worst imaginings, along with the best imaginings, are important to face head on. I think I sleep a little better at night knowing that I've played something out in a fictive way, whether that thing ends dreadfully or ecstatically. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that I'm inoculating myself in a sense, and yet I'm completely naked and exposing myself in the other. So it's an interesting question, but I think that's, you know, that's what I do. You know, I got bitten by a spider last week.
Wow.
And I had to take antibiotics for a week.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very strange and unexpected thing that happened to me. You know, I wanted suddenly to get all those guys from that great show Venom ER, you know, on the phone. But I mean, the unexpected endlessly happens. So I think that's what all writers do. They play out the dream. Something that you know, we're living this dream, and we know kind of the parameters of this dream. We know the borders of the room. But once we step outside the room, that's the mystery.
Just one thing about that spider. Was it a tarantula?
No, don't know what it was. I don't, you know, it was not clearly a brown recluse or something that, you know, it didn't do tissue damage, which is one of my favorite phrases, by the way. But it was enough to be extremely painful. You know, I felt as if I'd been shot with a BB gun for 10 days, you know. So, this is California as well.
Well, let this be a lesson to you. See, you prepare for the worst, you write about the worst, but then the thing that happens to you is something you hadn't even thought of.
There you have it. And then there are the antibiotics.
Bruce Wagner, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bruce Wagner's new novel is called The Chrysanthemum Palace. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes, and from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to stay active, eat right, and make brain health a personal and national priority at alz.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer and editor James Atlas talks about his new memoir, My Life in the Middle Ages, which reflects on being middle-aged. And we talk with Reza Aslan about his new History of Islam, No God But God, and his own experiences fleeing Iran with his parents after the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.